Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Dr. Barry Blackwell has spent half a century working as a psychiatrist, but as his medical career was winding down, he decided to pen a memoir that was anecdotal but also poetic. Literally. Bits and pieces of a psychiatrist's life chronicles Blackwell's varied experiences and prolific accomplishments, and it includes poetry he wrote over the course of his career. Ahead of his appearance tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company, Blackwell visited the Lake Effect studio to discuss his new book. He tells Lake Effect's Rachel Bloom that he believes breaking up his life and career into bits and pieces made the task less daunting.
A lot of this, of course, was written over the years. It wasn't all written in a short period of time. Mm-hmm. Some of it came from Christmas letters 20, 30 years ago. When I came to Milwaukee in 1980, I was 44, 45 years old. And a couple of years later, I did some creative writing courses at UWM. And I had a couple of pieces published in the UWM student magazine. After I convinced them I really was a student because I looked too old. So it was nice to be able to put it all together in one place.
And after publishing hundreds of scientific articles, what inspired you to take your writing in a more creative direction?
Well, actually, I've wanted to do creative writing since I was a medical student. There's a story in there about how my anatomy tutor wanted me to write an essay about the blood supply to the uterus. My essay was so florid, he said to me, "Blackwell, one day you'll end up writing for Reader's Digest."
I actually noticed that in your prose style, there's a lot of alliteration. And I thought to myself, was this influenced by your poetic training?
No, I don't think so. I think it was the other way around because the creative writing came first and the poetry came later. It was only after I took that class with Jim Hazard and because he was a poet, urged me to give it a try.
I'd like to ask you about your choice to publish the book yourself. Was there a particular reason you had in mind?
No, not really. I mean, as you probably know now, they say there are about 500,000 new books a year published, and half of those are self-published. And I think part of it is just that that's so much easier to do. I mean, it's a choice. You can either go for an established publisher like Harper & Row, and it's a big hurdle to jump. Or you can say, well, look, I'm doing this mostly for myself and my family and friends, so why bother to jump that hurdle? It's only after you've done that you discover what you've bought into in terms of the problems of getting anybody to read it. In my introduction, what I say is it's in lieu of a funeral or any of the trappings that go with it. It's a way of saying thank you to people and also in a way of saying goodbye.
I actually wanted to talk a little bit more about your family and not just your family, but the Blackwell name itself. You charted the surname's lineage over a wide range of families that you weren't related to, but they happened to share a lot of values that you also appreciated.
I think that's right. You know, the problem with most genealogy is it's boring. I mean, I came from a blue-collar family background. Wasn't too much to be found out about it, and most of what you could find out was deadly boring. But the name itself, it's one of those toponymic names that started as a name of a place, Blackwell. And it goes back to the year 900 and something when there was a list of five different villages in England called Blackwell. So you have at least five different genetic lines going into this. And I haven't a clue which one of them I'm related to. But I thought it was interesting to pick out. There's such an awful lot of interesting stuff in there. You know, Elizabeth yes. Blackwell, the first woman doctor, her sister Emily, the second woman doctor, Nettie Brown Blackwell, the first woman minister in America. I mean, it's an astounding catalog of interesting people.
Speaking of your lineage in Britain, you've actually lived in a lot of different places over the course of your lifetime. You spent some of your childhood in India, you came of age in Britain, and then you spent your adult life in Milwaukee. And in portions of this memoir, you reflect upon your experience as an immigrant to America.
Yes.
You also compare the relative political climates of Britain and America. It comes off as a bit of a pessimistic view of the American system, particularly the American healthcare system.
Actually, if you talk to my friends in England now, they're having the same problems in England because in the end, it really comes down to the expense of healthcare. And although Britain had a national healthcare, which was actually set up on my 14th birthday, it's crumbling. There isn't enough money to keep it going nicely. Nobody's happy with it, not the doctors, not the patients. It's not just as simple as having one or not having a healthcare system. But I do think it's time that America had one, partly just because of the cost. I mean, if you can't get healthcare now, you know, you can go bankrupt or just die.
Do you see the system improving? Are you optimistic?
I am optimistic. I think the Affordable Health Care Act, the Obamacare, is going to make some profound changes.
So you were involved in a diverse array of medical fields, and you spent time as a family practitioner.
Well, I trained first as a psychiatrist. Only after I'd completed a total of 5 or 6 years of training, including 2 years of pharmacology, I just decided that I wasn't ready to give up the whole breadth of medicine. And I went into family practice with a man who was actually the commanding officer in my reserve field ambulance and a friend. I did that for about a year and a half and realized it was a mistake, and that's when I came to America.
So I had actually known about the adverse reactions of MAOIs, which are used to treat atypical depression, and consuming foods like cheese, but I never knew how researchers arrived at that conclusion, and you were actually quite instrumental in that discovery.
Well, it's very interesting because I first became interested in the MAO inhibitors when I was doing a 6-month neurology internship before I did psychiatry. And I had a resident who supervised me who had actually seen a patient taking a drug called Parnate who'd had a subarachnoid hemorrhage following high blood pressure. And he knew it was due to a side effect of the Parnate. And so he told me, every time you see a subarachnoid hemorrhage, you've got to take a history to see whether the patient has been taking Parnate. Did it for 6 months, didn't see a thing. Then in 1962, I became a resident at the Maudsley Hospital, which is the Institute of Psychiatry in London. I was sitting in the cafeteria one day. I heard the residents at the next table to me talking about a patient who'd had a subarachnoid hemorrhage. So I said, well, was she taking any medication? Well, she was taking Parnate. It turned out subsequently that the meal that she'd eaten on the menu last night, because she was a vegetarian, was a cheese quiche. So it really aroused my interest. Cheese is mostly made up of protein, and as it matures, the bacteria in the cheese, and they're always there, they break down the protein to the amino acids, and then another bacterium converts the amino acids into tyramine. And both tyrosine, the amino acid, and tyramine, the one that does the damage, raises the blood pressure, both of those were discovered in cheese and named after the Greek word for cheese, which is tyros.
So a lot of the research that you conducted was in the era before the establishment of the International Review Board. Do you ever question the ethical implications of the research that you pioneered?
Yes, I do. I actually found a woman whose name I still remember and her husband. She'd been taking Parnate. I told her what I wanted to do and she was willing to take the cheese. I sat by her bed for 2 hours and nothing happened. And within 10 minutes of leaving the bedside, the nurse called me up and said, could she give her aspirin for a headache? I rushed back to the bedside and she was in the middle of a hypertensive crisis. Like all of those crises, it only lasted for half an hour to an hour, and she didn't suffer any harm, but I did expose her to harm. And the other story about that is, at the time I was actually doing the next piece of research on the metabolic unit at the hospital, I had a woman who had been not eating cheese, she stopped eating cheese, she volunteered to come into the metabolic unit. And for a whole week, she stayed there, and I ran through a series of experiments in which we varied the dose of the tyramine and studied how much of it was necessary to increase the blood pressure and at what point she experienced symptoms. Again, she didn't suffer any harm. But about 3 months later, I had a call from her family doctor to say she had died. And at the autopsy, they found she had a subarachnoid hemorrhage. So I wondered whether she had used the information that we gave during the experimentation to kill herself. We had incidentally offered her therapy, which she had turned down. So, yes, there were some ethical issues.
Also, I think it's something that's implicit in being a medical practitioner that there might be adverse reactions that you couldn't predict. I've noticed in the book there were many instances where there wasn't the knowledge required to diagnose something properly and then a patient wound up dying or suffering. How do you reconcile that with your commitment to helping others as a physician?
One of the things that I think a lot about is what medical education is all about. And what it's really about is producing two end products. You want to have a person who is competent and knows as much as they can know and therefore is safe. And you want to have someone who's caring. The competency thing tends to trump the compassion caring thing. I think the story you're alluding to was when I left psychiatry and went into family practice. Back in those days, you did not have to take special training to become a family doctor. Anybody could do it as soon as they graduated from medical school. A very intelligent man who I'd never seen before, a businessman, came in complaining of pain in his leg. I examined him. I couldn't find anything other than some local tenderness. I prescribed heat and analgesics. He has a wife who was a nurse, and I felt that that would be all right. 2 days later, his wife called the office up and said he dropped dead while he was dressing in the morning. And, of course, what he had had was a pulmonary embolus. And he had told me that he traveled by air to India and back. And I didn't know. I had not been educated, and I don't think anybody knew it back in those days, that air travel was a risk factor. There are other examples in the book.
Throughout the book, you are quite critical of Big Pharma, and you emphasize the profit motives that tend to drive progress in psychiatry. I was wondering whether you had gotten a chance to review the newest edition of the DSM, which is the psychiatric guidebook.
No, but I think like a lot of other serious neuropsychopharmacologists, we really feel the DSM has done a disservice to research because it's really based on the phenotype. In other words, it's a bit like diagnosing pain or fever and looking for treatments for it without knowing the underlying cause, because it's the underlying genetic cause that really determines the response to drugs. And those categories have become so heterogeneous and diverse that there's some suspicion that the industry has loved that because it creates what they call market share. And the other thing is the lack of specificity. In the early 60s and 70s, the quest was to find the right drug for the right patient. Failed totally. The field itself has come to a full stop, really. Most of the good clinical work that was funded by the NIMH has stopped, and it's switched much more into basic neuroscience again. But there are no longer any really good, astute clinicians left to have dialogue with the neuroscientists. And the industry is getting out of the area because they realize that they can't find new drugs in that area now.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your involvement with the Oral History Project.
The premier organization in neuropsychopharmacology is the American College of Neuropsychopharmacology. I became a member of that in the 1970s. Then they began to do a project called the Oral History, in which they did one-hour interviews by a peer about any discovery they had made. The idea was to turn those interviews into books. And so I ended up editing 2 of the 10 volumes and writing over 50 of the biographies of the people who made the original discovery. And I was one of the people, so that's how I got hooked up into that. Actually, I'm still working with Tom Bann. We've set up an international website on the history of neuropsychopharmacology, because the feelings we have is that there are a lot of lessons to be learned from the history. You know, that's a very controversial subject. The ACNP itself has tended to sort of deride history because they always want to be moving on and they want to be capturing the money from the industry. And so I think there's a need for a really independent website. My task on the website is to run a project on controversies. It's inhn.com.
So this show is called Lake Effect, and you happen to write a poem called Lake Effect, and I was wondering if you'd like to recite that for us.
I'd be happy to. This is in a section of the book that's dedicated to beauty. Tepid steam rising from ice floes, a bronze sun glistening on frigid snow, barren branches spawning newborn icicles, divine alchemy forging God's gold.
Very nice. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for visiting with us today.
You're welcome. It's been fun. Thank you.
Dr. Barry Blackwell is a psychiatrist, Milwaukee resident, and the author of Bits and Pieces of a Psychiatrist's Life, his new memoir. Blackwell will speak about his book Wednesday evening at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. There are links to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Blackwell spoke with Rachel Bloom. We travel to Napa Valley next with Lake Effect contributor Ray Pfister, who gives us an inside look at one of the industry's largest and most successful fundraising events. We're back with that conversation when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.